Sickles, and I'm here with Kendi Kiefel, and this is the cold open number 43, the Do You Like Peanut Butter Sandwiches edition. No.
Yes.
No, actually, it's the licorice pizza edition, but quoting Bradley Cooper's
yes,
last line.
Yes, yes, my favorite. Oh my gosh.
So this pod is a long time in the making. And it's been a long time in the making, not so much because we haven't wanted to do it. We actually agreed to do this podcast probably in October with the understanding that the film would come out in late December. But it's interesting to talk about our lack of access to it, Kenda, because I think it tells us something about a moment in the American film industry. This film did not come to Walla Walla until late February.
Right.
And when it was here for only 2 weeks, and it seemed like a small miracle that it was here that long. And while it was not here, Letters for Jordan was here for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And the Christian football movie, American Underdog, hell, that fucker still might be here.
I think it's still here. It's insane. Yes.
It just wouldn't leave. And every, you know, like Wednesday, you'd see what's coming out on Thursday night or Friday. It's like, how is Letters for Jordan and American Underdog still here? And I understand, like, American Underdog, the people that finance, market, and distribute Christian cinema are really good at their jobs.
They are. They're powerful too at this point.
They know their market. Yes. That film would not be here if there wasn't an audience for it. No, it wasn't, and they don't book it in for a set amount of time. So clearly people were going to see it. So they kept it here. But conversely, Letters for Jordan, like, I just can't imagine that there was an audience for that film.
Yeah. No, it is absolutely baffling. How did it win out over Licorice Pizza? You're right. That tiny run did feel like a miracle that it even came here. But yeah, as you know, I'm happy you saw it while it was here, correct? In the theater twice. And we were so stoked. And then everybody got COVID in our house. So it was tragic because this was one of the movies I was most looking forward to this year. Having spoken about it with you for so long, I was so happy that it did become available thanks to you telling us so quickly on Google Play. But you're right, it's telling of our area and just that access point that you're making. So happy to finally see it though. Yeah, can I hear your theater experience?
Well, the Spider-Man movie is still here.
Oh,
that was literally okay. So we have 12 theaters in our local cinema, and it's a nice theater. It's Cinemark. It's great seats. I like their snacks. I like being a part of their regular, you know, I'm a platinum member of their regular club.
Because
I go to so many movies. But Spider-Man played, on 8 of the 12 screens for a month. And it was just here forever. And now this weekend, Morbius is coming. And it is playing on the majority of screens. So it's just telling, and I don't blame them, right? When we went and saw Spider-Man, we waited like maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Same with Batman, and they were packed. They were absolutely packed. And whereas Licorice Pizza was a very sparse crowd.
Oh,
it just was.
Yeah.
It goes.
Which is kind of a bummer because when I pictured you all getting to go, I pictured some crowd that went with the movie as in like a 70s like raucous theater experience, I guess. And so that's interesting that it was quieter than that. So
it definitely was. I wouldn't say it was subdued per se because there is a cultish following, if you will. The people that were there to see Licorice Pizza were there to see Licorice Pizza, if that makes sense.
They weren't really there.
They weren't there to be part of the cultural moment. Where I feel like a lot of the people, obviously there's a fan culture around Spider-Man, but I think a lot of people just want to go see it because that's what people, that's the thing. That
it's what you
people
do.
Are doing.
Yes, for sure. That's how the Batman crowd felt when we went to. So
I had that same experience. So it was... It was electrifying. I found it just absolutely amazing experience. Far and away the best film that I saw last year, with the caveat being that it's it's different. Like, it's not going to be for everyone. Whereas, like, a film like King Richard, I found him, like Hallmarkish, like a Lifetime movie. I just did not feel that it was, it's fine. I didn't feel it was particularly cinematic. I didn't feel it was particularly interesting. I didn't, Will Smith was fine in it, but he was, in from my point of view, he was imitative and not interpretive.
Beautiful.
Whereas a lot of the people in the Licorice Pizza that were playing, you know, at least versions thereof, real people felt incredibly interpretive. They weren't just playing imitations of those characters. And obviously, so much of the movie is loosely based on real people and real events. So it was a really neat experience. How about watching it at home on the smaller screen? What was that like?
It was absolutely, it was exciting. It was magical. We made it a thing, and it was captivating. I, from start to finish, you know, a little anticipation and excitement around it, of course, but I felt like it was elevated 5 minutes in when it was like, oh, this is going to be fun. You know, this is going to be really something. And I enjoyed it so, so much. First and second, we watched it a couple times actually. And it was immersive. I love what you're saying about Will Smith's performance in King Richard, because this all felt, you're right, like either the archetypes or the actual people it's based on. You could hear Sarah Vowell talks about, in just to invoke another Paul Thomas Anderson film, she talks about in Magnolia what he got out of Tom Cruise, because she says, I think this is the first time we ever heard him breathe. And I feel like these characters in Licorice Pizza, we hear them breathe like metaphorically, right? Where they give so much life, and to have the whole Haim family as the family of Alana is so pleasurable and funny. And I've read that they improvised most of their lines, which I thought was genius as a construct. And I just thought it was brilliant. I absolutely, I'm so on the side of our main characters, right, too. They were just brilliant, I thought. A revelation. Yeah. And fun. It was fun. And, you know, that was, I was curious what the momentum was going to feel like. And it really carried itself in an utterly delicious way, I thought. And I feel like Bradley Cooper, if I can speak to your peanut butter sandwich, beautiful reference, embodied the power of the sort of engine of this movie, in that it was so, so great in the character investment, in just the way that people, the decisions everyone made as the characters that they were, like, he felt like an excellent, like, nugget, a distilled version of what was powerful about this movie, the vignettes and the, like, the just character driven romance of it. Anthony Lane called it the comedy of hope, which I thought was cool, great. And that it was shaggy with happenings. And I just love those phrases.
Oh, I really like that.
Isn't that good?
It's almost picaresque.
Yes.
Or anecdotal. Nice. It's not plot driven.
No.
It's just not. The sense that, okay, there's a romance at the heart of it, but it's certainly offbeat, but it's also, there's no goal-oriented protagonist per se. There's no event, there's no major thing they're working towards.
Right.
It's the series of vignettes,
these
small moments that each in and of themselves are kind of perfectly crafted gems.
Yes.
And what I was really struck by that I enjoyed was the lightness of it, which is not historically PTA's forte, I would argue. I think Boogie Nights is one of the funniest films ever made.
Yeah.
Like, it is really funny.
It is.
And there are funny moments in all of his other films, other than, like, there's not a lot of humor in There Will Be Blood or The Master.
No, The Master, yeah, exactly. Right? No, there is not. It's pretty dark in a good
really
way.
Dark.
Yeah.
And I think Inherent Vice is pretty funny, but
yes.
It's just, you don't think of him as a comedic director, and I thought this movie, I've now seen it three times, twice in the big screen and then once at home in preparation for a discussion. It's really funny.
Like, it is.
Really funny from start to finish. Yes. I laughed, and there's just, there is an affection for the characters, the moment, and the time that just bleeds through with every element that you see on screen. The cinematography, the music, the clothes, the tone of the feel. It's just a loving film for the era. And he hasn't made a film like this since Boogie Nights.
No, I agree. Yeah.
And I don't know that that doesn't mean these other films that he hasn't made, many of them aren't of high quality. They certainly are. But a lot of his films, I think, increasingly alienate audiences.
Yeah.
even as they do better than you think they would. A film like Phantom Thread is just weird.
Yes.
And also funny.
Yes, it was funny. But it's so niche feeling compared to this, which felt like, I guess at least for us, a crowd pleaser and connected to Boogie Nights in an interesting way. I couldn't agree more. I was thinking of it almost as a sister piece, but also as like, not quite an antidote, but there are some shared threads there, but also the like sheer, I love affection as a word that's so good. And the sheer innocence of what I feel like we're given to follow in Licorice Pizza is so, so endearing, so lovely. And I like the way it travels. You're right. There is no discernible plot. My friend on this 32-hour road trip we just took was asking me to explain the point of Licorice Pizza as I was thinking about getting to talk to you about it. And it was like, no, it's truly an immersive, character-driven set of attempts, stories, and sort of, I guess, interesting clues about 1973, but also sort of transcending the time and place in the sort of spirit of what it feels like to have dreams and be young, right? Or be lost and be young. I love that about Alana's character, that I really appreciate Hoffman at 15 knowing and starting multiple businesses. And on the flip side, I love Alana's sort of searching in her mid-20s. I just thought they were such a great pair. And am I correct that this is based on a very specific story about a chaperone for a young actor? I feel like these characters were based very in detail on real people. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
Gary Valentine, as yes. played by Cooper Hoffman, is based on Gary Getzman.
Okay.
And Gary Getzman is a friend of Paul Thomas Anderson's who delivered waterbeds to John Peters' house.
Wow.
He was once escorted by a burlesque dancer
That's right.
to New York to do a similar skit. When he was younger, he starred in a movie that was similar to the one that we see in this with Lucille Ball. It was called, I think it was called Under One Roof. And, you know, went and did a skit like that. So that is okay. loosely based on that. He did sell a waterbed.
Okay.
He did have something to do with pinball machines. The real Joel Walks, who was an actual congressperson or whatever it is, city councilman in Los Angeles, did run for mayor in 1973. And believe it or not, Gary Getzman shot his campaign commercial. So
what?
Like that, yes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Right? Which apparently never aired. So obviously like it's hyper-fictionalized, but there is some moment
yeah.
in truth. The Sean Penn character is loosely based on William Holden. The Tom Waits character is loosely based on John Huston.
Nice.
You just have these kind of moments. So there's truth in it, but then it's kind of wildly fictionalized
yes.
for comedic effect in a really kind of fun and interesting way.
Absolutely. No, thank you. Thank you for those connections. I forgot about the burlesque dancer aspect of that chaperone's life. Thank you. That's beautiful to know. I think that's extraordinary that he shot the campaign video. That is the background connection of these sort of fictionalized characters. It's very satisfying to learn. But the pinball place, the palace that they built for shooting this movie fooled a lot of people in Los Angeles into thinking that it was a new pinball emporium. And as you know, my husband and I collect pinball machines. And so Jeremy started doing research because we got so excited about that aspect of the entrepreneurial practices of Gary. And it was such a beautiful, like, movie immersed in real life sort of thread that people started to believe that a real pinball place was going up in LA, and they were so bummed to it. It was just this temporary beautiful dream of Paul Thomas Anderson's, but I just really liked that fiction becoming real for like the true believers in pinball. I just thought that was funny. Oh, can I just say, maybe my favorite performance besides our lovely main characters was Harriet Sampson Harris as that casting agent. That was such a crazy bit of genius that she was up to in that role. I just am so impressed with the performances that PTA gets out of his people, but that specificity and sort of horror show aspect of being sort of analyzed as a potential actress in LA was just genius to me. I thought she deserves many awards for that. What did you think of that moment?
It was laugh out loud. Yes. So funny. I missed so much of it the first time because I was laughing.
Yes.
Nice. So hard that you're a goddamn fucking fighter. That's yes. what you are. It's yes. just, it's really funny. But
it's so good.
Also based on real life kind of legendary casting agent Sue Menders.
Mm. Okay.
So there's truth, like a legendary Hollywood figure, there's truth in that as well. So again, though, like that goes to nothing. It doesn't build towards anything. It's
right.
It's just
it's a moment,
a moment yes. in time in the film.
Yes.
And the way that time is structured in this is fairly wonderful in that you don't get a sense of how much time has passed
yes.
between the moments. They're just moments that take place over the course of however long it is that this happens.
Oh, that's interesting. You're absolutely right. In which it starts to seem like we are listening to the recollections, perhaps, of the two main characters. I feel like those moments in time would stand out or be the story you tell when you're Gary 40 years hence, right? Or like those like sort of golden formative pieces that are also these everyday moments. I love that. I think that's so interesting. I have to tell you, there was, having just watched The French Dispatch, there was something that felt more than any other Paul Thomas Anderson anything, connected a tiny bit to Wes Anderson to me in this movie. And I did not expect that. And I thought it was charming to me. But still Anderson's style, but there was something about the quaintness of it, about the even a little bit of the humor that felt like he was I don't know, influenced or paying homage just a little bit to Wes Anderson. What do you think about that?
Oh, I really like that analogy. So one of the things that I love about Wes Anderson's films is they always feel personal. And even if they don't have anything to do with his life story experience, he personalizes it in such a way with his signature kind of look, yeah. feel, and tone. They feel like he's very much like invested in this. And obviously Paul Thomas Anderson is invested in it yeah. as well. But There Will Be Blood does not feel personal.
No, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. The Master does not feel personal. And this film does feel personal. Yes. He was young in the 70s, but he definitely like grew up in the San Fernando Valley in the 70s, and I think wanted to capture the tone and feel of that era. So there is a lovingness
yes.
to what the way that this film seems to come off that is just simply not present in any of his other films, with the exception of, again, maybe Boogie Nights.
Yes.
And Boogie Nights was a passion project.
This it's a film passion
yeah,
project.
He'd worked yes. on that for a decade in various forms before it came to be. So yes.
That's great. No, exactly. And can I just say, with Boogie, thinking about another connection that I just thought about just now with those two, that is actually maybe the opposite of what Wes Anderson does, as Wes Anderson totally makes things personal. I fully agree. And then stages everything, as in we are behind the camera always, I feel like. What Paul Thomas Anderson does in this, that I think is to great effect, also done in Boogie Nights, is that side camera behind the camera. Everyone sort of creating the illusion, but we get to go behind the scenes. I feel like there was, you know, as we watch Hoffman like change outfits and get back in front of the camera for that commercial audition, right? But we see the casting agents, we see in Boogie Nights like the whole room, right? And I didn't think about that until you just said that what he does for us, that feels personal, right? That just that aspect of being backstage, right? And even when they go on the trip, and there's that pajama party, or what is it called? With what Alana is chaperoning for, I feel like even that we see mostly as much backstage as we see front stage, right? And I feel like he's so good at that, just letting you in, you know?
And there is some similarity to Boogie Nights. Time period's a little different. I think Boogie Nights started in 77. Okay. It starts in 73. But the young Eddie Adams from Torrance, right?
Yes.
Who becomes Dirk Diggler is not as precocious ever. Not as smart.
Right.
As Gary Valentine. No. They're similar. They're young and they're trying to discover their way.
Yeah.
In the world. And you know, they're participating in the film industry at various ends. They're trying to find their thing. There are moments that are similar from the movie. There's the audition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a very famous audition in Boogie Nights, but we also have his audition. There is the filming in 16 millimeter, right? There's moments where they make like that Dirk Diggler documentary, which feels similar in filming the Joel Walks thing, and that it's like this, it's kind of more handmade DIY approach to filmmaking that we see, but it just captures that era so well. And it seems less set design than Boogie Nights.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Even though Boogie Nights is meticulous in its look, there's a few things that are better than Eddie Adams' bedroom.
Yes.
With all the posters and such to capture that
so
feel.
Good.
But it somehow this felt to me more organic. Did that to
I
you?
Agree. Yes.
Like it seemed less forced.
Absolutely. No, I agree completely that it was the intimate rooms that we are given access to, but more so sitting in, I feel like, with Licorice Pizza. I feel like that feeling is also embodied in the waterbed scene where Gary is looking up at the beautiful like sales girl, and we see her upside down and him starting to get the next idea. There is such a shared space feeling to Gary's living room too, and Alana's house, and the way that things sort of invite you in to sit in the room with the other characters. I love that point. It does feel less staged and yet equally believable, right? As the era, right? And as if you are traveling along, sitting next to these people, right? I feel like that was so beautifully filmed in the waterbed truck scene for that backing down the hill scene when they run out of gas. I loved that so much, and it felt so very present and immersive, and it was really delightful in that sense too, where it's like, oh, these are our friends too, you know. It was beautiful.
Did you know that she actually did the driving?
What?
She went to truck driving school for 2 months.
Oh my god.
And did the stunt driving herself.
I love her so much. That is awesome.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. So, is there anything she can't do either?
Right?
Oh my god, that's so good.
In the movie theater, they played a song called Last Track, which is a Haim song that was a PTA-directed video before the movie started, which is really cool to see that. And unfortunately, you don't get that experience at home when you rent it. I want to talk just a little more about the look and feel and about kind of the way that it might look. And it goes back to my sense that this is personal. I'm a little older than PTA. I think I'm a year older than he is. But I also grew up in California in the 70s. And it matches my memories. Like, it looks like my memories. It's golden. It's sun-spotted. Like, it's kind of washed out. Kind of looks like Polaroids from the 70s. There's that sense. And the colors are vibrant, but they're not necessarily, like, Technicolor. It doesn't feel like overly saturated. It's just kind of this like washed out, dreamy tone, somewhat very reminiscent of Virgin Suicides, right? The look of that film as well. But it again, you know, another kid that grew up in California in the 70s with Coppola, or at least the first 9 years of her life.
That's beautiful. Yes, yeah. This shared aesthetic and palette, color palette. That's beautiful.
It just looks like the era. And I can't, I can't know if it looks like it to people who weren't there, but I haven't talked to anybody who was there who wasn't struck by just how much the look matched their memories. And that's a really interesting trick. And to get back to this idea of personalism, for the most part, Robert Elswit shot his most famous films. He shot Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk, There Will Be Blood. Then he didn't shoot The Master, but he came back and shot Inherent Vice. And then supposedly they had some sort of falling out for Phantom Thread. And PTA supposedly shot Phantom Thread. Okay. And there is no credited cinematographer for that movie, which is very unusual.
Yes. But
you know, when you hear Paul Thomas Anderson talk about the shooting of that film and his obsessiveness of finding lenses from the era to capture the look, which supposedly he did for this as well. So it's really interesting. So the credited director of photography for this film is Paul Thomas Anderson and Michael Bauman. And it's both of their first director of photography credit. Neither of them have actually had that credit before as, you know, the primary cinematographer. But Bauman is a gaffer. He's kind of a lighting person and has huge, long, extensive career and has worked on many of Paul Thomas Anderson's films, kind of a longtime colleague of his. So I can't help but think like they were able to communicate in such a way because the lighting is so important to the look of this film. And PTA apparently spent quite a bit of time trying to find period lenses. You know, he's still shooting in film. Like nobody's shooting in film, right?
Sure.
He's definitely still shooting in film. And he found period lenses, but their collaboration, even though it's the first DP credit for both, obviously this is the end product of a years long working relationship to kind of create that magnificent tone and feel. And it gives me pause for what comes next, Kenda, if we can circle back around just briefly to what we talked about at the beginning. And I just don't know that there's a theatrical future for films like this. Like he's so wants to make these kinds of films that he makes, you know, the auteurist, writer, director, and apparently DP.
Yes. also
films. And people want to work with him, like big name actors, you know, enjoy working with him. And if you think of like his muses, it's Daniel Day-Lewis and Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman. And he's worked with some of the preeminent actors of this, the last 20 years. That said, boy, can I see an era in the near future where maybe they don't want to give the money that it takes to make something on film like this that doesn't have a real possibility for heavy financial reward. It's got the possibility of critical cachet, which of course this this had as well. But I don't want to watch this movie at home, but I'm really scared that that might be its future.
I'm scared too. And even the idea in that background of searching for the right lenses and not working in digital, I could see that shifting in a hideous way, as in like not being funded to be genuine and to respect the era by using the sort of more analog practices. Like I really hate the idea of that being removed from the practice as well as the theatrical release. But I could kind of horrifyingly see that same possibility of everything sort of being stripped out of what makes it beautiful and nostalgic and specific, as you were saying. Like, I love hearing that it's a piece of your memory too, and that he got it so right. And I can't see that being simulated in a way, right? Like with say cheaper digital practices to film even a similar story, right? Like, he needs to work in with those tools, right? To really, I think I feel like that's part of his artistry, right? I hope he continues to be supported in that. But I was curious, even given the tone of this, what is next for him? Because I, even Inherent Vice, like, I felt like that was an interesting, I love that movie and I think it's so funny. And I like how he is willing to evolve while still undeniably himself, and his own, his style is so distinctive, but also so varied. And I forgot he did Punch Drunk Love. That's how wide and beautiful his resume is. So I'm curious what story he'll tell next, as well as what tools he'll be allowed to continue with, right? So I hope so, though. I guess that's my dream, because I would have much preferred seeing it in the theater as well. This kind of movie feels like that's what it deserves.
So in addition to like the color and the tone and just like the feel of it, it was alive.
Yeah,
there's so much motion. Yes. Not obviously the running.
Yes, lots of running.
Yeah, but there's just motion. It felt alive.
Yes.
Like every frame was just crackling with energy and life.
Yes.
And it does not, like, just having just watched it on a very big TV screen, 75 inches, it's not anything near the experience. It's just not, no matter how good it is at home, it's
yes.
not watching it, you know, on a 50 foot or 100 foot
right.
Movie screen.
With the big speakers and that, as you said, the soundtrack is so excellent. And even, I agree, the crackling, the dialogue and the way that you know, conversation is captured and exchanged is so, it's so snappy and excellent while still feeling completely genuine, I feel like, in that movie. I think it's really spectacular the way he even captured that initial meeting of them. But the walk along sort of side scroll, snappy repartee of it all was so funny and beautiful. And it really, I just really quickly want to say too, the fact that you recognized your own childhood in this, but that he is so good that we all recognize something of ourselves in his practice, in the way that he makes things personal while being universal. It's such a spectacular equation that he varies but hits, I feel like, almost every time. But this felt like pure, right?
So let me ask you, all the press before this movie focused a lot on Cooper Hoffman. It is a strong connection. He was very close to Philip Seymour Hoffman. Obviously, we lost him tragically and young, and he's still friends, you know, a part of Cooper Hoffman's life. He did not write this for Hoffman. He wasn't meant to be cast. They couldn't find somebody. And it was actually supposedly Alana Haim who said, well, what about Cooper? Who happened to meet him through their work with Paul Thomas Anderson, who's directed a bunch of their music videos, and how they know each other is nuts. The Haim's mom taught art in schools, and she was Paul Thomas Anderson's art teacher. So that is
amazing.
Like, right? That's the connection.
So good. Oh, I love that so much.
But they met Cooper Hoffman on a video shoot, and that's kind of how it came to be. But
what?
He is so naturalistic in this film.
Yes.
But in watching it kind of this third time around, he doesn't have much to say. He's
yes.
not, and I'm not talking about like content, I'm just talking about like as in actual lines.
Yes.
He doesn't, he's got some killer lines, but in retrospect, it's not his movie. It's not about Gary Valentine. It's about Alana. Like,
it is.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And I wanted to know if you thought, for the most part, this was something different for him. He's had great female characters. He's had Amber Waves, yes. Julia Moore's Amber Waves.
Yes.
And he's had the Emily Watson character in Punch Drunk playing Lena. And Alma, obviously, the Vicky Krieps character in Phantom Thread. And you could argue that Phantom Thread is Alma's movie, but I don't know if it is or not. But I don't think you can argue that this is anybody's movie but the Alana characters. And that's very different for him. So tell me what you think about that.
It's absolutely different for him. I felt like that was a revelation. It felt like he really thought about and embodied like her point of view, her character. And I couldn't agree more with this story actually belonging to her. I feel like we are feeling things. I feel like she is our in more so than Gary is, even though he's a great captivating character and an important piece. I think that we are so with her and on her side, but this felt like he internally understood her character way more, I think, even though you're right, he has had some fantastic female characters. She is him also. She embodies the multitudes I feel like are being laid bare, but also like translated for us in his voice and hers, if that makes sense. I feel like he really wrote from her point of view, and it felt like incredibly, that her character felt incredibly personal for me, and it felt so real and so I guess relatable and universal in the struggle, but also the like, I appreciate her sass and her confidence and her willingness to play, right? Her like her sort of presence and presentness with whatever the vignette requires, right? Like, I like that she's game and that we see a huge spectrum of emotions, more so than Gary, I would also argue. I feel like Gary's life seems a little more painful, even though we don't necessarily know the details of his father's absence. Like, we don't go into that. And he, I'm sure, could communicate those emotions, but we don't see the same sort of, I feel like, we just watched The Simpsons with the feel bad rainbow, but that's the term I keep thinking of, where we see her react in such intricate ways to Sean Penn's character and to the levels of realization and disappointment and charm and back again. Like, she has, she is us, I feel like, and she really lets us in, and Paul Thomas Anderson lets us in to these subtle cues that she was brilliant at, right?
I would be interested in seeing her do something else. Her facial expressions were magnificent. But that's the essence of movie acting, right? Yes. You have to express so much with your face.
Yes.
In close-up, yes. Right? And not overact, etc. Yes. And clearly he saw something in her. He wrote it for her. The character has her name, and it's like, yes, she's never acted before, but she's a performer, like, yes. like a world-renowned performer.
Yes, she's like a stage presence, yeah, that's really good already.
Yeah, she's a rock star.
Yes,
her videos,
exactly,
are great.
Yes.
And not just because he shoots a lot of them, but all three of them are really good.
They're amazing
in them.
Yeah.
And so, but in the sense that it was written for her, you wonder if she's playing some facet of herself, mm-hmm, that she brings to it. And when you read interviews with her, and she talks about the moments where she improvised, like, it was actually she improvised asking the Lance character, what does your penis look like?
That's awesome.
There's a bunch of different lines, but they're in character, but they're in the character of Alana, but they're also Alana,
yes,
that came up with them. Like, they're so... It's great. Historically been a criticism of actors like John Wayne or Cary Grant, et cetera, that they're just playing themselves.
Right.
And I suppose you could make that criticism of her, like, after, yes, all, it was written specifically for her. But I just saw what looked like a wealth of talent
Yes.
And
yes.
I would just love to see her in something else.
Me too. I would follow her anywhere. Like I want to see her play other characters. I completely agree. I was immediately struck by the way the light in her eyes, like how that was captured, her flicker, like was so real, but so captivating. Yeah, I really love performers who will play less successful versions of themselves. If she is playing a version, I love that the struggle is real, even though you could argue that her life has been success after success, right? And a Taylor Swift friendship. But I feel like that is so cool that she could be vulnerable after being an obviously successful performer, right? Like, I think that's an incredible feat in itself. And every time people are able to do that, I'm thinking even of Bridget Everett in Somebody Somewhere. I don't know if you've seen that show, but
it's incredible, right? Such it's a good show.
Sorry. Joel's the best. I love that the characters are kind to each other, but I'm just thinking, you know, she has enjoyed obvious successes, even though there was like lots of cabaret work before then. But I love that she can go back and tell the version of her own story where she has to move home and struggle and have identity crises after crises. And I just connect that to Alana's character in that she can play like searching and unsuccessful while coming from a successful place, if that makes sense. And I think that's incredible.
It does. And there's something that certain actors have that can't be taught. And that's like magnetism. Like how you draw people to you. And I don't necessarily know that that's a skill. It's just kind of inherent. And I would argue both Cooper Hoffman and Alana Haim, neither is anything close to conventionally attractive, even in real life, the way that we think of when we think of movie actors. And yet they're so appealing.
They're
just drawn to them.
Yes.
And there's an intangible that some people are just able to bring to the screen. And sometimes that person is Brad Pitt, right?
Right.
Who people have called like the world's most attractive character actor because he's great in small roles, but it's still fucking Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Undeniable, right? Yeah.
Neither of these are, but they have that undefinable, intangible it factor.
They really have it.
Kind of glows on screen, like crackles.
Totally crackles. Such charisma, you can't look away. You're right. It's that it factor. I love the idea of that, where just sort of recognizing and trusting that Alana could do this too, writing it for her, like knowing her natural charisma, which she clearly has in spades, but also Hoffman too. Like, you're right, you cannot manufacture it, you cannot fake it, even with incredibly beautiful people. Like, some people have screen absence, but these two, that's clear from second one that we are going to love them, we are going to follow them, and they, every time they're on screen, are going to do something interesting and amazing. It's gold. I don't know.
For actors that I care about and whose work that I admire, beauty's a bonus, not a requirement.
Well said.
And every once in a while, some of them have it, and that's great. And it's like makes it more appealing. But there's just something about what they do that draws your attention to them. So one last thing I wanted to talk to you about that was pretty wonderful for this movie. Like, again, Johnny Greenwood does the score, but unlike There Will Be Blood or The Master, I didn't find the score like particularly noticeable or interesting or revolutionary in any way as compared to some of his other work. But it was all about the soundtrack. It's the return to Boogie Nights. I mean, again, he hasn't really done it since then. There is pop songs in some of his other movies, but this is very reminiscent of the Boogie Nights soundtrack, although completely different, but equally as effective. And for me, I know what I thought the best needle drop of the best of many, many, many great needle drops in this film was, but I want to know kind of what your favorite music, what did you think of the soundtrack and what was your favorite musical moment?
I loved the soundtrack so much. You're right. It was thick and rich it got me thinking about song rights because it felt like dense with needle drops. What's the David Bowie song that's also in the preview? This might be a
Life on Mars.
Life on Mars. Thank you. That to me, it's been stuck in my head ever since. And it's such an exciting, beautiful use of that song. I realize it's in the preview, so that might be a lamer answer, but I love the way that song just felt all the feelings of the movie to me. How about you? What's your favorite needle drop? What was yours?
There were so many, but the use of Paul McCartney and Wings, Let Me Roll It. That was so, it was after that scene with Jack Holden, the Sean Penn character based on William Holden, where she like fell off the back of the bike and they went back and they're both lying on the waterbed that is lit from underneath and they're looking up and their fingers touch like just ever so sweetly as that music is playing. And it's like there's an art to the deep cut, right? It's totally. Not like Paul McCartney and Wings have obscure songs per se, but it is like not as well known as many of the other things. So to be able to do that, and that was a moment like, it just, I found it like overwhelmingly powerful, the amalgamation of all the varying elements, and it was the perfect point in the film for that to come through. And I just felt like I was in the hands of a master.
Thank you
for bringing me to this moment in the theater that I live for, that you so rarely get to see on the big screen. And I just thought, man, I fucking love movies.
Yes. And that, you're right though, that particular moment with their hands in silhouette almost, right? We see their like just forms, right? In the most beautiful way, the underglow. That is such a gorgeous moment. That was a gift from him to you and all of us, right? Where it's, that's right. That embodies what is possible, right? With the needle drop, with lighting, with cinema, with characters, and that's gorgeous, Robert. I agree completely. That's a fantastic part. But the overall choices, I do feel like, of the soundtrack and the way that he just so deliciously placed things was part of his art. Part of his like pure genius, right? Which I feel like is consistently important to him, but I didn't really notice the score, as you said, either, but it does feel like the greatest soundtrack in recent years of any movie we've watched. So.
Well, and the scores in his more recent films and his films beginning really with Punch Drunk Love, like the scores are really noticeable. They're really noticeable and really a key part of the film. So, one last thing.
Please.
Long Way Down. to reference Boogie Nights again. So, it is no secret to anybody that knows me that I'm obsessed with Paul Thomas Anderson. Like, I have been forever since I first saw actually Heart 8 when I was living in Reno in grad school. But then Boogie Nights thereafter. And I teach a class that is my favorite class to teach that's not a filmmaking class, that is called The Magnificent Andersons, where we watch all the films of Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson. I'm amazing. So excited. I'm teaching again next year.
Can I take your class? That sounds so fun.
Please.
That's the best idea. I wasn't going
to teach it next year, and then I'm totally teaching it next year.
Yes.
There's two new films.
Yes.
There's two new films to add to it. So one of the things I always do at the end of the semester is I make the kids rank the films. And Wes Anderson's made more than Paul Thomas Anderson. He's a little more prolific. But I just wondered, like, where is this for you? Mm-hmm. What, rather than giving like a specific, like ranking a top nine list, he's made these nine features. Like, what's better than this? Like, which one would you put above this film?
I mean, maybe, well, no, I wouldn't put Boogie Nights above it. I see them in parallel. I going back to their sort of tandem relay quality of connected tissue. I feel, oh gosh, I don't know what goes above it. It might be my favorite to date. It was so delightful, right? And so I love that you use the word light, because I don't know what wins over it. Although I will tell you, I had a similar feeling with Inherent Vice, where I was like, oh God, I love this. I just want to watch it 4 more times. So that might be tied. Can I ask you the same question? I don't know what wins. This and Boogie Nights are probably my tops so far. Although There Will Be Blood and all those, I love them. I love The Master. But as far as the walking away and wanting to revisit it at this point, I'm kind of in love with this movie. And it's kind of glowing. How about you? Does anything win over it?
Yeah. So I've got a bifurcated answer to this.
Okay.
The right answer is There Will Be Blood. It's the most important of his movies. It has the greatest critical reputation. It is widely considered, if not the best movie of the century so far. One of them, right? It's in the conversation.
Yeah.
That said, as much as I like it, and as much as I can't take my eyes off Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Dano.
He's spectacular.
I don't like get this overwhelming urge to watch it several times a year. So as much as I love it and I admire it, and as excellent as I think it is, and as much as I get its importance in film history, it doesn't give me pleasure in the same way that even like Punch Drunk Love gives me, which is like the secret masterpiece of like the underrated, I would argue that's the underrated Paul Thomas Anderson film, not among aficionados, but among the wider public. But I would say that prior to Licorice Pizza, my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson was undeniably Boogie Nights. Okay. It makes me laugh so hard every time I watch it. I love the performances. That anybody could get anything good out of Mark Wahlberg is kind of amazing, right?
It is. It's a miracle. Well, and just connecting that, Adam Sandler as well, like that performance that he got out of him. It's the best thing he's ever done.
That said, it is too long. It definitely I maybe watched that film 30 times, and there are still moments where it drags a little bit. The best moments are the best moments, right? I still look forward to that.
There's
not a moment I like more than the Rayad Jackson drug scene.
Oh my God. I was literally just thinking about that this morning.
With Sister Christian and Jesse's Girl and Love Balloons. It's a perfect scene cinematically. It might be Licorice Pizza.
It
might be Licorice Pizza.
Yes, that's beautiful.
After seeing it this is the test. Does it get better? And each successive viewing, I've noticed so much that I didn't. Okay. You just kind of pay attention to what happens the first time you watch a movie.
Right.
And you laugh at the laugh lines, etc. But now I'm looking at facial expressions and hand motions, and I'm paying a lot of attention to the camera and where music comes in and how, and there is just, it gives me pleasure.
Yes.
I watched it last night with a big, stupid, ear-to-ear grin from start to finish. I am just thrilled and delighted with this movie.
I'm with you. And don't you get I get the feeling and impression that Paul Thomas Anderson needed this. You know what I mean? As psychologically, right? Because There Will Be Blood, I totally hear and respect that critical acclaim and all, and the performances, but it breaks my freaking heart every time, as does The Master. It tears a hole in me every time. Whereas felt like that hole was filled with delight for Licorice Pizza. And I guess I feel like it was this time for him to like give himself this level of delight. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the sense I get, the pleasure that he seemed to have in making it, right? Like it just felt like a salve and a beautiful glowing memory, like you said
too. That's wonderful. Yeah, there's something about Watch, like I love the master and yes, I'm overwhelmed with the mastery and the cinematic achievement, but I'm not filled with joy.
Exactly. It's a little bit of homework. It's not the same kind of the smile that you describe as you watched it, where you just know you are going to like be immersed in this warm, gorgeous musical delight, right? This pleasure. So I love that point, and I do feel like it's a cool turn that he decided to make too, right? Like, I just like that he's open to making this kind of movie after making something like There Will Be Blood and all of the ways that he has pivoted in a sense. This feels like something new, but also purely what he was meant to create.
That's perfect. There's nothing more that we can say at this point. So we'll call it a podcast. Kinda, let me just say, it was so nice to podcast in person. Yes. We have not done this in so long. To not be looking at you on a Zoom screen is so great. So,
I couldn't agree more. No, it's a pleasure getting to be in the same room.
Yes, so good. It's so good. Hopefully the audience can feel the love. It's
yes,
just good.
That's right,
it's
exactly. Good. It matters. It matters to share a table.
It does. All right, so I'm Robert Sickles here for Kinda Kiefel, and this is the cold open number 43, the Licorice Pizza Edition.